Buddhist Summer School, Monday afternoon, 3rd September 1979. Let us recall the mandate which the Buddha gave to his bhikkhus, his disciples. Therefore, bhikkhus, ye to whom the truths I have perceived have been made known by me, having thoroughly made yourselves masters of them, practice them, meditate upon them, and spread them abroad, in order that pure religion may last long and be perpetuated, in order that it may continue to be for the good and happiness of the great multitudes, out of pity, compassion for the world, to the good and the gain and the weal of devas and men. The truths, in order that pure religion may last long for the good of all mankind. And these truths, as you all know, refer to the Four Noble Truths, the truth of suffering, the truth of the cause of suffering, the truth of the extinction of suffering, and the truth of the way to the extinction of that suffering. Of these four truths, the first two belong to the context of the world, the worldly life. They belong to the context of the finite, the mortal, subject to time, beginning, proceeding, ending, always after the uprising of anything whatsoever, there comes later on decay, decrepitude, death, attended with man's grief, misery, despair, and so forth. The other two truths, the third and the fourth, belong to the context of the transcendent, not of the world. In the context of the transcendent, is not finitude, it is the infinite, it is the eternal, not merely the timeless, but the eternal and the immortal. It is important, it is extremely important to appreciate, we can't appreciate fully, of course, but to sense at least the significance of that context of the transcendent. Because infinity, eternity, immortality are quite inconceivable. They are nondescript. That means that they cannot be described. We cannot imagine them. We cannot form pictures of them. The mind, as it functions in us as we are at present, is completely defeated where any sort of conceptualizing is concerned. Because the very act of conceptualizing is the act of limiting. The concept has to be definite. It has to belong to the realm of the finite. Something which can be compared with another, which can be placed in juxtaposition with another, and so forth. And also, therefore, no words can ever really convey as a precise fact that this is eternity or this is infinity. So that context of the transcendent is something completely other than our limited context of the finite and the mortal. But it must be clearly borne in mind, and this we can bear in mind, that the transcendent context completely subsumes, holds within itself the worldly context, the limited context. The greater contains the lesser. The lesser cannot measure that greater, which functions in terms which are utterly beyond all measurability by the lesser. Have you ever tried to take your teacup and measure the volume of the Atlantic? You see, it is like that. Now, it is extremely significant that all the great teachers affirmed the transcendent. But they affirmed the transcendent not merely as a completely other than, but as subsuming this here, which is the mortal. This is why there is the communication, the emergence, the communication of the worldly with the transcendent, and the emergence out of the limitations of worldliness into the unconditioned state of transcendence. Otherwise, religion would have no sense or meaning whatsoever. It would be another thing, like science or art or philosophy or economics or anything you like. I'm not using the word anything pejoratively, please do remember that. So now, these four truths were to be practiced, were to be mastered. That means that they were to be lived. The individual life was to be the representation of the mastery of these truths. And remember, the first two belong to the worldly context and the next two to the transcendent context. That means that the relationship of him who had mastered to transcendence was the relationship which is actual, perfect communion, at-one-ment. An atonement, therefore, for the worldly context. We must always bear that in mind when studying the deeps of religion, and particularly in all our practice of the deep religious teachings of the way to realization. Otherwise, we will remain self-centered. We will try to grasp transcendence. Far safer to grasp a blazing red-hot coal than to try to grasp transcendence. There was one called Lucifer who tried it, and he had little success. So now, master these truths, practice them, meditate upon them, in order that pure religion may last long. Pure religion. Religion, therefore, does not live by virtue of mere intellectual knowledge or presentation, howsoever eloquent. Religion lives insofar as you yourself are the embodiment of religion in its truest and deepest sense. We must feel at home with this. If we do not feel at home with this, then our religiousness, which is inherent in us, has no real chance of coming to full fruition. If and when it comes to full fruition, because we have gone rightly, then we are the true humans. Each one of us then is truly the Son of Man, in the pure and full sense of the word man. And it is truth which is concerned with religion. You know this saying in India, there is no religion higher than truth. Satyat na asti paro dharma. No religion higher than truth. And this truth, the meaning of the word truth in the religious context, is utterly different, and yet subsumes the meanings of truth in all the other contexts. Science, history, law, and so on. All those truths are truths within the limited context. This is what happened, or this is the fact, etc., etc. But they are all limited. Because the truth of religion is something which is unlimited, unconditioned, something which emerges into consciousness, not consciousness merely with the brain, but that profounder, deeper, unknowing consciousness. It emerges into that consciousness as one lives the truth. And as we live the truth, we are never personally aware, I am living the truth. If one may use words, it is the truth which is living in and through me, without my knowing it and recognizing it, obstructing it, and being separate from the living person. Now, in order that pure religion may last long, the context of the eternal rides on the wings of time, may live long, but what has eternal life to do with length of life? It is eternal. There is nothing to measure with. But it implies that the difference between the two may be probably the difference in our own mode of awareness. What undergoes the change is our own mode of awareness of existence, of the total reality. This is what changes. But otherwise, the entire cosmos, the entire universe, and all that we do not know, and that will be infinitely greater than what little we do know, it means that all that is one great unity which everlastingly is. That lovely saying, as it was in the beginning, is now and ever shall be, is perhaps as little a misleading verbal expression of a truth whose profundity is so immense that our limited consciousness, our minds, can never grasp all of it. This is one of the reasons, perhaps, why in the Upanishads the Brahmins, the great Brahminical teachers, the perfected holy ones, not merely equated, but said categorically that absolute consciousness, Atma, Brahman, were all an identity. They were one and the same thing. They were not a not-two-ness, or a not-three-ness, or a two-in-one, a three, a trinity in a unity, and so forth. They absolutely identified them. If you like to play with things tremendous, numinous, imagine God in Eckhart's sense of Gottheit, in the Hindu sense of Brahman. Imagine God conscious of his creation. Now, is there any going to be any difference between that awareness of self as the absolute totality and the being of God? There cannot be. But don't play with it too long, otherwise you might like to play with something else which is not quite so quite reverential. It's a serious matter. Because if there is irreverence in our thought process, then we shall suffer the ill effects of it. And the more tremendous the powers with which we play in our imagination, the more terrible is the consequence to us. Let us go on. This word religion is derived from the Latin legere, as some say, Cicero said that, and or religare, as Servius, Lactantius, St. Augustine declared. Religare means to gather together. Religare means to fasten or bind back. But bind back to what? To transcendence itself. The unknown, the unknowable, the beyond everything. To bind back. They gave that definition. Can you or I bind back something which is completely beyond us. Where are we going to hook it on? We can't. And yet, these great ones made that statement, to bind back to transcendence. One has to let the mind be very quiet and peaceful and just let the verbal presentation speak to us. Don't muse on it. Don't churn up the ocean of words inside the brain. Then we only get a brainstorm, not truth. The truth will speak to us if we let the mind be quiet and remain in an observant, alert state. This is very important. Now, obviously, to bind back to transcendence means to restore to by complete relationship with the context of the infinite, eternal, immortal. Now, if they said that, and if the great spiritual teachers of the world accepted that, taught that in fact, and they themselves are said to be the representatives of that, then obviously there are chords of communion available between ourselves as we are and that transcendence. And it is our senses, our physical senses to start with, which are the primary and perhaps the most important chords of communion. Because if we use our senses in the right way, if we let them function as they were meant to function, when brought into being through the activity of that primordial creative power, whatever it is, that energy which produces cosmos out of chaos. If we let that happen, then the psyche will become more and more purified, and mind, this tremendous universal energy, an archetypal form of this primordial creative energy, will begin to function unobstructedly through our psychophysical organism. The effects will show themselves in course of time, because our mode of perceiving into the depths, understanding, conceiving and talking bears the impress of that actuality, that transformation. These things have very deep and important significances and implications. Don't try to search for them deliberately. Deliberate searching has greed, possessiveness, as one of the elements behind deliberate searching. Let it happen. If there is love, if there is real, natural, spontaneous care for the meaning of existence and of life, then the purpose of our existence, it will reveal itself. When you truly love a person, you don't attempt to force that person to love you. You just wait patiently in a state of beggarliness, the divine beggar. And this is a wonderful state. That is the state of true search, because your whole being will be alert, waiting, waiting. And that waiting will never be long. In actuality, however long it may seem. Because in that type of waiting, our ordinary psychological time, which plays the devil with us all through our lives, our psychological time is in perfect assonance with the rhythm of life, of manifestation, and the rhythm of life of creation, which is action in eternity. It's very, very helpful to be able to feel this sort of thing. If one can feel it, not emotionally, please, not merely sensationally. Otherwise, it will run away with you. But quietly, let it happen, and divinity itself will function through you. Put it in Buddhistic terms, the unborn, the unbecome, the unmade. Nirvana itself will find no obstruction in you, and it will shine forth. So, let us have a look, whilst we are talking of this, the meaning of the word, the Latin word Deus, God. Deus means light, from Sanskrit div, transcendent light. Eternal light. Milton has written so beautifully in Paradise Lost, particularly the beginning of the third book of Paradise Lost. Absolutely wonderful, those few lines. Hail eternal light, it starts. It means Deus means transcendent light. And the Greek word theos, related to desire, means not desire as we desire, but transcendent love. Love and light, compassion and wisdom. It's extraordinary how these two factors run right through the great religions of the world. Now, one might say, why not other factors like goodness, beauty, and so forth? They are all there. But we, constituted as we are, and caring to live in such a manner that our destiny as man can be fulfilled, because of the nature of our constitution, love and wisdom seem to play the paramount part in our religious life and growth. It's a source of extraordinary happiness. It has been to me, certainly, a source of extraordinary happiness to just get a touch of these things, just a touch. If one little touch means such a remarkable peace and joy within the depths of one's being, what must be the peace and the bliss of God which passes understanding? What must be nirvana itself like? You see, the context of the transcendent slowly enters into and takes you up into itself, completely transforms, purifies, heals the context of the worldly. the context of suffering, death, sin, etc., ignorance. See, we have to try and appreciate. I use the word appreciate, but try and let it happen through one's being, sink into one's inner consciousness by itself. Now the Buddha taught that if you live the holy life, the way to the extinction of all suffering, then here and now, in this life, you will realize that state. The translation of the text is, you will realize. I would prefer to put it the other way. It realizes itself through you. It is always that which is bigger than oneself which contains one. I don't contain the room contains me. It's like that, surely. And you see, when one is clear-sighted enough to be conscious in that way, then there is no conceit. There is no striving for self. I may be the king of the castle, true enough, but the castle holds me. Now, the truths which he taught, the Buddha taught, are called the Dhamma, the Dharma. This word Dhamma or Dharma, the Sanskrit form, Dharma, its root is Dri. You have often heard me say this, but it bears repetition. This root, Dri, means to uphold. What is it that we uphold? Where the truths of religion are concerned. Way back in the Rig Veda, this upholding was clearly presented. You uphold Ritta, the eternal order of things. Inherent in the entire universe of manifestation, in each and every thing and in each and every person, inherent in everything, is the operation of law. It's the operation of that primordial creative energy which brings a thing into being, maintains it, allows it to change, transform, and fulfill its particular purpose of existence. That is within us. It is from that that we derive our sense of the moral imperative. In the Rig Veda, Varuna is presented anthropomorphically, if you like, as the god of law, of virtue. This is virtue. This creative power acting as law and order. Whatsoever manifests without obstructing it, the law and order of its own being, Ritta, the Ritta of its own being, is virtue embodied and manifest. And insofar as this, we go against this virtue, and we human beings are the ones who have this extraordinary power, and more often than not, the unhappy power of saying nay to virtue, in the real sense. Not merely a laid down mores, a laid down morality, a mental fixation. It becomes a mental fixation. If and when we understand the so-called laid down virtues fully, if we really understand them, then they are no longer mental fixations. Why? Because our understanding has made this laid down virtue so real, so alive, that it is at one, it is in complete unison with transcendent virtue. Virtue, that is why I like to define virtue as soul strength. I found that a helpful way of regarding virtue. Otherwise, the acceptance of the laid down virtues or their rejection violently, especially in our young days, because we think we know better, they are both binding factors. But let be alert, caring, really caring for that which is right, and the right will function happily through you. To be virtuous for man, as pure man, is a natural and spontaneous thing. But I, the ordinary man as I am not yet truly human man. I am subhuman. Not yet arrived at that state of fruition where body and mind, I separate the two purely for convenience, it's just one thing, the psychophysical being. Body and mind have come to maturity. You may remember yesterday, I think it was yesterday, wasn't it? I said a few words about the marriage made in heaven and its counterpart in our life, that the masculine and feminine elements which every man and woman has within himself or herself, when they are in harmony, that is the worldly representation of that primordial prototype, the marriage made in heaven. So, this will be a truly indissoluble marriage. What God hath put together, let no man put asunder. Virtue. Out of where the religious life is concerned, derive everything not from here to transcendence, but let transcendence speak to you. Start from the other shore, so to say. Don't start from this shore. Start from the other shore, the paradox. Because if that paradox, If we can respond to that paradox, then there is no possibility of what we call failure, nor is there going to be any success. The right thing happens naturally and spontaneously. And in that there is neither success nor failure. This is the beauty of existence, of the whole universe, of our personal lives too. What are the experiences that you find are the most wonderful experiences? Not mere ecstatic experiences and so forth, because ecstasy is all too often an unbalance. But that which just happens simply, naturally, and you say, and you don't say anything in fact, you just experience it through the sense avenues. That is why I said a little earlier that the senses are amongst the most important cords of communion. So, this upholding of the eternal order of things, which cannot be done in terms of our limited consciousness, by our deliberation, by our preferential choice, because the transcendent accepts everything. It rejects nothing. Otherwise, it cannot be transcendent. Acceptance and rejection, the conflict, the duality between the two has disappeared there. Now, so much for the meaning of Dhamma, three, to uphold. Now look at the word dukkha, suffering. We all know its worldly meaning, not merely in one or two ways, but unhappily in 100 or 200 ways. We know the meaning of suffering. What do we do with regard to this meaning of suffering, the worldly meaning? We try to get rid of it, which is a mistake. We rarely try to understand it and its place and purpose in our life and in our growth towards mature, complete humanness. So we try to counteract, or we take some tranquilizer, some dope of some sort or other. Physically, we all know about tranquilizers. But psychically, we do precisely the same. We run here, we run there for comfort, we try to forget, we turn our eyes away, we behave like ostriches and so forth. No. Understand the suffering. Be wholly open to it. The worldly suffering. Be vulnerable in the true sense of the word. That does not mean that one spinelessly, masochistically calls suffering upon oneself. If it comes, don't face it as an antagonist. Look at it and see. This is suffering. Otherwise, we will always say, oh, my suffering. And as long as we confine ourselves self-concernedly, self-centeredly to ourselves, we shall miss the tremendous value of suffering. This is merely in worldly terms. Look at the transcendent aspect of suffering. All of us, I'm sure all of us here anyway, and in groups like these throughout the world, have some sort of care, some sort of natural, irrepressible love and an outgoing towards the transcendent, the perfect, in the true sense of the word. And this sense of transcendence tells us that, oh, the real communion is not here. I am away from it. This is the supreme sorrow. This is the transcendent passion. And if this passion did not function, even in a small way, to start with, we'd never turn to religion in the right way. How do we turn to God when we suffer? How do we turn to the Buddha or the teacher or whoever it is? Oh, please do this for me. I predetermine with my petty little intellect, my imperfect mind, I try to dictate how Tao, transcendent, should help me. But is that the way for the fulfillment of transcendence itself through this person, through this being? Obviously not. Therefore, don't try to run away from suffering or get rid of it. Understand, in the process of understanding, there will emerge compassion. True compassion, because one will not want one's own suffering. I will not say, I want to be free of my suffering. This is suffering, and it is not confined to me. All the world suffers similarly. In this form, that form, a thousand forms. And all of us suffer in all those thousand forms. When that happens, then this power of compassion and this perception into the true nature of suffering transforms the stuff of suffering into virtue. And this is the value of it. So this transcendent suffering is one of the most powerful influences to make us approach religious living in the right way. Approach religious living not for my sake, for my nirvana, my kingdom of heaven. You can't book seats, even by placing your handbags or anything, in the kingdom of heaven. Cannot be done. Now, the cause of suffering, tanha, trishna, the thirst for sentient, not existence merely, it is usually translated as the thirst for sentient existence. But without sentient existence, there'd be no person at all to grow and become the full Son of Man, etc. All the rest would be just non-existent, you see. It is the thirst for sensational delights. And the confinement to sensational delights for oneself. This is tanha. It is also associated with fear, with anxiety. It is also associated with the aggressive passion to achieve, and so forth. So, One has to look into this, see it functioning within ourselves, and then we shall be free of all desire, of all clinging to or longing for sensational delight. And what happens then? If my worldly desire undergoes transformation, the will, the desire, the longing of transcendence — this is an absurd way of putting, because transcendence hasn't got desire, will and longing as you and I have and understand — but whatsoever those poor words represent will function through you. And then there is fulfillment. Through you yourself, the finite mortal individual of the infinite and the immortal. And for you, in this life here and now, there will be — I can't find the best word for it yet. Let me just say fruition, fulfillment. One of the purposes of your individual existence will be fulfilled. And in that type of fulfillment, the great archetypal forces of the primordial creative energy, as insofar as we can apprehend them, will continuously manifest through you. And that is one of the main reasons why the religious man has to have this indispensable basis of complete purity, because if that isn't there, those archetypal energies are so powerful that they'll break you. But be awake to it, and there will be, as the Buddha said to Pottapada, which I quoted yesterday, there will be peace and joy and happiness, your happiness.